Take me where the promises are real.
All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problem that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the privilege of introducing our speaker tonight. For a long time, I did not know Steve's name. I knew him as the donut guy from the 11 o'clock meeting because he always was bringing in tubs of donuts. And then I learned his name, and I don't really know him well, so I'm interested in hearing his story. I do know that he was just elected to the board of NAVA, so service is a big part of his life. You're in for a treat. So, thank you.
I hope that's not the on my tombstone, the donut man. Although there have been times in my life where I looked like a donut. I'm fortunately in one of the thin stages. My name's Steve and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, everybody. I got to tell you a little story. And it probably happened back in 1984. My sobriety date is January 4th, 1982. And my home group is the 11 o'clock Bridge Builders meeting, 11 and 11:30 on the weekend Bridge Builders meeting. And me and my roommate, we used to, there was a place over on Buford Highway that a bunch of us in the program lived. It was called the Buford Ranch. And Care lived over there. And Chuck and Pat Schultz, who helped start the NA in this part of the country. We had a gal above us that was in the program, and she had her 1 year birthday, and she asked this guy to speak for him, for her. And this guy, man, this guy was freaking old. I mean, he was ancient, you know. And he got he told his story. And so this is like in 84, 85. He told his story, and he only got as far as World War II. I mean, this guy was ancient. And he said, well, I'm doing better. Last time I only got through with World War I. So I'm really happy that Tim invited me to come back, because the last time I spoke here about 3 or 4 years ago, I only got to like 1984. And then I turned around and looked, and I was out of time. And so I only got as far as 1984. So hopefully I'm going to get maybe into the 90s or the 2000s today. I'm really honored to be here at this place that's been so important to my sobriety, and that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit tonight. Is why NAB is so important to me. Skyland has always been my home group for 30 something years, but NAB was like my second home. You know, coming to meetings during the day, coming to the 8 o'clock. Big book study, or it wasn't a big book, it was a step study, a 12 study back there that Bob Carver. I'm going to say a lot of names, and a lot of these names aren't going to mean a lot to most of you, but what they do is they mean a lot to me, and they're the people that made a difference in my sobriety. And you probably, I hope, have people, if you've been sober a while, have people that you know that have said things and done things for you and meant things to you that kept you sober. And if you're new, and if you're not that sober, you're going to have those people in your life that mean something to you, that said the exact right thing at the exact right time, that made a difference in your sobriety. Because, frankly, you know, she read something about, you know, trying not to be in bad taste. Well, my relationship with my higher power has been a rocky one, to say the least. The higher power that I knew in my childhood and I long since parted company. And my big part of my higher power is in this meeting, is a group of drunks, is good orderly direction that comes from AA and 12 steps. And to me, God works through people. And so I listen to people a lot. I've been to a lot of meetings, and I've heard a lot of people. I heard a lot of people say a lot of things. Some of it, well, you know, kind of iffy. One time at Peachford, we had a meeting. It was an 11 o'clock meeting at night, and the meeting was, of the whole hour, was having to pee in cups. Basically, that was the subject of the meeting, of having to drop drug screens. So we talked about it, and we, you know, talked it out and everything out, and I stayed sober even so. But most of these people, though, are they've been very important in my life. And I just feel honored up here to be in the same place that Stan Parks sits on the front of this, or Roland Bryce, or Joe Hubbard, who used to stand up here and do meetings. You know, people that were like heroes to me. And, you know, I said it when I picked up my 30-year chip. I said I've never been so unimpressed with 30 years before in my life. Because the people that had that much time when I was new, they were like these bigger-than-life people. They were so, like Maggie at Biscayne, or Joe Hubbard here, or Joe Phelan at Skyland. They were just like these big, I mean, they were, I made them my higher power. They were gods to me, you know, they really were. And come to find out, they all have feet of clay, and so do I. And so if I could live up to a tenth of what they do, I would be happy. So my story starts here in Atlanta. I'm an Atlanta native. Family dates back to the 1840s in Atlanta, so way, 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 way back. My great-great-grandfather was a mayor of Atlanta in the 1870s, a state treasurer in 1880, and impeached for embezzlement in 1881, to tell a family secret. We had the biggest house in Atlanta at one time, or my family did. We ain't got squat. But the family had the biggest house. It was opposite of the Capitol downtown. And, of course, the family, you know, the first generation or two makes it, the second, third generation keeps it going, and the third or fourth waste it. And it ended up being a home for wayward girls, you know, once we went up, our family went broke. But the legacy that comes from all that is this kind of sense that I'm better than everybody else, and this conceit and this arrogance. And so I got to tell you, speaking of conceit and arrogance, so I went to go grab the big book and go pray in the bathroom before the meeting, you know, because anything that comes out of my mouth, therefore, is God's problem and not mine. So I don't know whether this is really arrogance or this is really an ego or it's just an old person. So I made a big deal. I said, oh, I'm going into the bathroom to pray. I'm going into the bathroom to pray. I got to get my glasses. I got to go pray. So I went in there. Used the facilities, came back out, and I forgot to pray. So, I don't know whether I'm like, you know, my ego's getting old or I'm getting old and forgetful, but then I had to go back and pray again. God said, yeah, you're getting old and forgetful, and don't forget who's in charge. So he's in charge. So I came from my mother's side of the family. My grandfather was German, and my grandmother was Irish. They had 11 kids. And my mother grew up around the Depression era. And her family was the best part of my family. My father's family was from the old part, you know, thinking they're better than everybody else. And it was a big deal for my dad to lower himself to marry my mother because she wasn't Catholic. They weren't, you know, old money and all that stuff. And that's the best part of my family, comes from the part of that. And they raised 11 kids, and all of them, which is a big deal in the Depression, had a high school education, and they all learned a musical instrument. And some of them became you know, wealthy and famous. The other part of my family just kind of withered like a old Southern Gothic novel, you know. But that didn't mean that I didn't inherit that kind of thinking I'm better than everybody else. And at the same time, my dad and mother got divorced when I was 5, and my dad died when I was 8. So And I was just talking to my sister about this, and she said, you know, we were talking about growing up, and her experience growing up was middle class. They never, you know, they weren't rich by any stretch, but, you know, they never wanted for anything. You know, dad was a good provider for her and the rest of the kids. And I come from a typical Catholic family, which means that I had a sister, then 2 years, then a sister, then 2 years, then a sister, then 2 years, then a son. And then I came along about 6 years later. I was the rhythm method baby. So, you know, all of them are much older than me, and they have a much different experience than I had growing up. But growing up, it was my mom trying to raise 5 kids by herself and never had had a job and had to teach herself how to be a secretary. And I just went to a concert down at Ponce Market, and I was telling Matt, I said, you know, my mom used to work during Christmas time. She used to work a second job up at the catalog, up at, you know, in the top floors of the Sears building there on Ponce de Leon. And so my mom had to work really hard to raise us, and we didn't have that much. So here I am thinking I'm better than everybody else, but in my mind, poorer than a church mouse. So it was kind of this dichotomy that a lot of us come in with is, you know, thinking we're better than everybody else, but at the same time, we're, you know, just lower than low. I was smarter than the average bear when I was young. By the time I got to first grade, I could read and write and add, subtract, and multiply and divide. All the girls, because they were much older in the neighborhood, would come home and play with me and teach me school, and, you know, I would help them with their homework. I was a little precocious little kid. And what that did, though, is it cost me, it wasn't really like I had an abnormal childhood, but at the same time, anything that they were going over in school, I had already done. And so I became the class clown, and discipline became a problem. I started doing poorly in school because I already knew it and didn't do it, so I just started goofing off and having trouble. So mom sent me to, we moved to here to Chamblee. We lived in Decatur, now we moved to Chamblee, and my mom sent me to Marist, to a good Catholic high school run by priests, which was better than the nuns, believe me. The nuns could be a bit sadistic. So I, while in high school, I finished the 10th grade. Between the 10th and 11th grade, I discovered other substances. I'm going to try to state a singleness of purpose while I'm here. But I started out using other substances. A friend of mine from earlier in my life came back, and he turned me on, so we started it up, and that started a real downward spiral for me, because I as soon as it happened, the lights turned on, and I was there. I'm really kind of a member of the CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic, you know, and I really embraced that lifestyle. So I left Marist and then went to Chamblee for 2 years and left there and went to Open Campus for 2 quarters and left there and then got a GED and then went off to school and went off to college. In college, I was my first quarter or two, I did well, but then I had a warrant out for me down in Carrollton, so I had to leave town. So I went to a school out in Colorado. I went out there and did well the first quarter, but then the second quarter, I had a .83 GPA. It was time to come home, so I came home to the University of Georgia. I didn't tell them about that part of my academic record, so they took me in, and I achieved a 0.0 grade point average in 1 year at the University of Georgia. Normally, you had to be an athlete to have that kind of sterling GPA, but I achieved it all on my own. I was living in the dorm, and finally, the first quarter, I kind of went halfway through the quarter. The second quarter, I attended the first day. In the third quarter, I just didn't even go to school. And finally, the RA came to me and said, Steve, are you going to school here? Are you going to class? And I went, no. I majored in beer drinking and foosball playing and guitar playing and girl chasing and everything else that the whole college animal house experience, really. So I was asked to leave the University of Georgia. And really, I could have come into the program right then. My drinking, that's where my drinking really took off, was at the University of Georgia. One example of how I used to drink was, you know, of course, they had parties at houses. I never was big in the Greek life, so I always drank off campus, either at bars or at house parties. And my idea, this is an example of how I drank, was I would be in the kitchen because that's where the keg was. And so what it was is I would stand in line, I'd fill up my beer, and then I would get back in line because once I got back to the front, my beer was half empty and it needed filling again. And I would just spend all my life, all the time at the party, in the kitchen going around. And there was one particular party where I did this. It was just the circular firing squad of me, a circular drinking squad, really, of me just going around and around. And I was bad to black out. I was bad to drink. I was bad to puke. And I was bad to have hangovers. This particular party, I went outside and I puked. And then I came back in and started drinking again, just like a Roman orgy of old, except it was just all about drinking. That's not normal drinking. The first time I had a drink, really, was we had gotten into some trouble. We had a high school party at a hotel off of Roswell Road, and it got busted. And we got off of it, and me and Tim Wagner, we got Sterling Big Mouth, a six-pack of Sterling Big Mouth. And beforehand, most of my adventuring had to do with drugs. Now it started going around alcohol because alcohol was safe. I could buy it. Back then, you could buy it when you were 18. I could buy alcohol. I could have it in the car. I wasn't going to get thrown in jail for having alcohol, and I felt safe. And back then, you could kind of ream up DUIs fairly easy. It wasn't like today where you get two and you're in jail. So I. But that was the first drinking of that time with Tim. I drank all that I had to drink. I blacked out. I got sick, and I woke up with a hangover. And that was pretty much the pattern of my drinking. I drank as much as there was to drink. I blacked out. I had periods of blackouts coming back and blackouts and coming back. I would get sick, and I would wake up with a hangover. I didn't learn until I came into the program about drinking the next day. I could have, you know, if I had listened, you know, if I'd known you guys, you know, you professional drinkers. So when I finished, gotten thrown out of the University of Georgia, the money ran out, and I moved back home to go to a tech school, a computer tech school, and went through there and became a computer tech and had somewhat of a career. I know, it's hard to believe that I had a career. But I did have a career at one time. I was a young little boy wonder, 22 years old, the second youngest kid hired nationally. And so I did really well until they wanted to transfer me to Dallas, Texas. I would always drink. I was not like an everyday drinker. I was like a weekend drinker. And one of the reasons I drank like that was because I never knew what was going to happen. You know, if we went to lunch and I had a beer, I didn't know whether I was going to stay there and drink all day and blow off the rest of work, or if I went to happy hour, whether I would have two beers and then go home, or I would stay there all night. So I pretty much drank around the weekends. And towards the end of my drinking, it pretty much began to be like every other day of the weekend, like Friday night, and then I'd be so hungover I couldn't really drink Saturday night, and so I'd drink Sunday. Or vice versa, I'd drink Thursday night. And I would always miss just enough times that I had days off. All my days off, all my sick days, I was never sick. I was always hungover. And it's a real pleasure to call in sick from a payphone on Peachtree Road, you know, saying, I feel really bad today. And there's the car zipping by and honking and everything. And you're calling in like you're at home in bed and you're sick and you got the flu, when really you just stumbled out of somebody's apartment that you've never seen before and will never see again. And you're trying to call in sick because I'm too hungover. So that was the method. That was the way I drank. Down at the University of Georgia also, about my blackout drinking, I woke up one time in my bed, and I had a bruise on my head and bruise on my elbows and bruises on my knees. And I didn't remember anything. So they told me, they said, well, we found you in the toilet stall with your pants, with you holding your pants like this, face down on the ground. So apparently I'd been sitting down, tried to get up, pulling my pants up, and just fell over, hit my head, my elbows, and my knees. And that's where they found me and then put me into bed. I had a really hard time with part of the program because So anyway, I'll get to that when I get into treatment. My string kind of ran out the last couple of years of my career, and the last couple of years of my drinking is that the whiskey wasn't working anymore. It wasn't getting me where I needed to get. And all of a sudden, I was that sad person at the end of the bar trying to drink as much as I could drink, and there just wasn't enough alcohol there. They couldn't serve me enough to get where I could feel better. You know, every alcohol knows the ease and comfort that comes at once from a drink. I couldn't find that anymore. There was no ease and comfort left. And it hadn't been for 2 years. And I was the bewildered one. I just couldn't understand what was wrong with me. You know, the only thing that I knew was that I was terribly lonely, terribly sad, terribly drunk, you know, and my life was a mess. I had a friend that tried to kill himself and checked himself into Petrie, or got checked into Petrie. So I said, man, you know, I hit my bottom on New Year's Eve 1981 and New Year's Eve morning 1982. A friend of mine has a picture of me from about that time, and I have a cigarette in one hand, I have some green alcohol in the other, I have a brandy snifter in this hand, and I have a beer in this hand, and no doubt there's white alcohol up my nose. I mean, I did as much as I could, as hard as I could, as fast as I could, until it either ran out or ran out of money or I passed out or blacked out. And that was the way I drank. There was no... The thing that people talk about, you know, it's the illusion of every abnormal drinker that he can someday drink as a normal person can drink. I won't say never, but very, very, very rarely drank as a normal drinker. I drank to get drunk. Period. End of story. Occasionally, I would have to be, at a family dinner and have a glass of wine, you know. But then it was always trying to get the hell out so I could go get drunk. So I never drank like a normal person. And fortunately, I don't have that persistent kind of illusion that I can ever drink like a normal person, because I never did. One of the things that when I woke up in detox, they had a big book down at the bottom of my bed. And I picked it up, and I was 26 years old. And I went, no, 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 well, let's not look at that, no. I mean, all I did was look at it and say, that's not me, that's not me, that's not me, that's not me. I'm not that person. And so it was difficult for me to, especially one of the things that it talks about all the time is, you know, alcoholic, somebody who tries to quit but can't quit. I don't recall ever trying to quit drinking in my whole life. My problem wasn't that I wanted to stop drinking and I couldn't stay stopped. My problem was that I needed a drink and couldn't drink enough. That was my problem. There wasn't enough alcohol in the world. So that was a difficulty. It turns out there's other people like me in the program that are just like that. And when I, after a while being sober, when I read it to the agnostics, it says if when trying to quit, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you find you cannot control the amount that you drink. I went, oh, hey, maybe I am in here. That was how I came back in, how I came in the side door. Another thing is that one of the counselors said that non-alcoholics don't have blackouts, and I was a blackout drinker. And so I said, okay, intellectually I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I can understand that. But when I went to my first meetings, if you want what we have, man, I didn't want what you guys had. I really didn't. You know, y'all were just too scary, too happy, too, you know, frankly, too cultish. I was afraid I was going to sell flowers down at the airport, you know, and, you know, live in a house, a pink house, and wear robes or something. You know, we love you. So I was really scared. Again, I felt better than all of you, and at the same time, I knew that I wasn't. I knew that I wasn't, because y'all had an answer that I didn't. So it wasn't so much that I wanted what you had, I didn't want what I had. And what I had was that feeling, that hole that couldn't be filled, there wasn't enough alcohol for me to fill. So I didn't want to feel bad enough, so I kind of came along that you know, I had blackouts, so I, you know, am probably an alcoholic. So I got a sponsor. I got real involved. My sponsor believed in service work. I got real involved. We started a clubhouse. We, you know, I was a GS, alternate GSR, then a GSR, and, you know, chairman of the steering of a regional committee and all this, and a convention. And it was real fun. Everybody was there having a good time and all. But somewhere along the line, I kind of lost what recovery is. I heard the greatest thing at this this event. The guy says you can't have recovery unless you have sobriety, and you can't keep sobriety unless you have recovery. So I can't get sober unless I'm sober, and I can't stay sober unless I get recovery. So I really like the way that the guy says it. And what I was doing was I was on a dry drunk. You know, I was working the first part of the first step, and we were having fun. We were clean and crazy, man. Or as Bill Roop used to say, stark raving sober. You know, and that's what I was stark raving sober. And so back to 1984, which is when I finished last time. I'm already there. I got 15 minutes to go. Yay for me. So about 1984, at about 18 months into my program, I had broken up with a girl in the program, and had been suicidal and just miserable. I felt worse than I felt like when I came in the program, if that's possible, because I was not treating my alcoholism at all. And so I kept going to meetings. I kept looking for an answer. A couple of things happened that really changed my life. One is I heard John H. speak over at Biscayne. And what he said was that sobriety is like a huge, he called it a smorgasbord, which is really an 80s kind of term. We call it a buffet now. But he said sobriety is like this big buffet, you know. And he said if you just want the appetizers, if you just want the salads, you know, just don't drink. And you won't wake up drunk. You won't get a hangover. You won't get a DUI. None of that bad stuff will happen. You won't black out. You won't have hangovers. But if you want the rest of the spiritual benefits that the program has to offer, that's where the rest of the steps come in. And the other thing that changed my life was here in Clancy in 1984 at the Roundup at the Atlanta Roundup. And he said a few things. What he talked about mostly was he ran something, the Midnight Mission out in L.A., and he used to serve 30,000 meals a month to the homeless out there. And most of them, he talked about how they were very, very low-bottom drunks. And he said he said you could ask him, is alcohol your problem? And they would say, no, alcohol is not my problem. And he said, that's exactly right, because alcohol is not my problem. My problem is alcoholism. And then he went on to say something that really resonated with me, and that's that not drinking has no effect upon alcoholism except to make it worse. And all of a sudden it just went, bingo, that's what my problem is. And that's when I took the first step at depth. That's when I knew I was an alcoholic, when I didn't treat my alcoholism and my life got worse. And so from that point, I got John to be my sponsor, and we went through the steps, and I got better. And I haven't been suicidally depressed in the program ever since. So that's my experience, strength, and hope when it comes to that, to working the steps right there and to having a higher power in my life. And now, it doesn't mean to say that there haven't been hard times, there haven't been tough times. You know, the program is no insulation from life. It hasn't been an insulation from life in my times. I've had, there was a time that, within about an 18-month period, my mom died, my sister died, both of them of lung cancer. Jennifer's father had a heart attack and died. I reconciled with the IRS. We bought a first house. And this was just all in a period of like a bunch of stressful things. And the great thing is that I never thought about drinking at all during that time. So my life from 1984 until now, it's not like you would think that, you know, it's been like this constant growth of spirit, you know, constant path of spiritual growth. But what I find in my sobriety is that it seems to be kind of like a sine wave. And in the beginning, it was very pronounced. You know, I come with my ass in a sling. I do a bunch of stuff. I get better. And then I start slacking off. And then, you know, my ass falls apart and my life falls apart. And then I pick up the tools again and start going to meetings. My first year, Pat Schultz at the time, she was my counselor at Peaceford, and she started the first NA meeting east of the Mississippi back in 1974, maybe. But she had her 10th year, and I only had like 6 months. But she was crying at her 10-year birthday, and I was taken aback because this was, again, one of those huge people that I put on a pedestal. And she was crying, and she was going through a rough time, and she said, "I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And what I took away from that, the lesson that I learned from that, is no matter what, the things that I learned when I was first new still work. You know, when my ass has gotten into a bind, I've gone to 90 meetings in 90 days. I've gone to more meetings. I've talked to more people. I've worked with more newcomers. I've done more service work. And the things that work when I was new and when I learned the tools of the program, they still work. Just because I've got a lot of time up sober in the program doesn't mean that life isn't going to turn to crap and I don't trough out. And the nice thing is that instead of being wild fluctuations, it's kind of a nice, gentle sine wave. And I hope that I'm growing up. That's Yeah, he used to say that he'd go to meetings, and he was going to go to meetings till he found out what the secret was. That y'all had a secret, and he didn't know what it was, but he was going to go to meetings till he found out what the hell it was. And just the past few years, I found out what the secret is, and that is that if I don't drink, and if I work the steps, and I live life on life's terms, I'm going to grow up. I really believe once I was in that 28-day program for 54 days at Peaceford. I was very sick and needed every bit of the days. And the day that I got out, that was 1982, and we had a huge ice storm, and the power went out, and we had it was a bad year, and it was a bad winter, but I was in treatment. And then when I got out, it was a day like today. The sun was shining. It was 65 degrees. Those Bradford pears were blooming, and it was like it truly was the beginning of the rest of my life. And when I was waking up there in Peaceford Hospital in the bed with this flatulent person that had some kind of intestinal problems, and instead of snoring or burping, he just farted all night. And I'm going, what the hell have I done with my life? My life's over. I was 26 years old, you know, and my life is over. And when I came out 54 days later, I felt like that I had a new beginning in life. And I did. And the nice thing is that every day can be that way. My relationship with my higher power has been iffy. One of the things I'm real grateful for is I had those 54 days in treatment so I could work through the second step. And I could work through the third step. Because when I looked up there, I said, oh, power greater than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then I look up there and I said, God. And I saw that G-O-D word. And man, me and him weren't on speaking terms at all. And I had to work through, at least intellectually, I worked through a relationship with my higher power. The coolest thing about now is that the higher power that I had then and the higher power that I have now are not anywhere near the same as they were. I thought that I had to understand everything about God and everything that there was about God in order to understand God, which was, you talk about arrogance. If I could understand God, I'd be God. And now I realize that I understand virtually nothing about God. The only thing is, my sponsor used to tell me, Elliot, you say, you can tap the source anywhere. And I really can. I can tap the source while I'm looking at a sunset or in an AA meeting or in a wedding or in a church or wherever. I can tap into that source. And I'm really grateful for that lesson. And for I was listening one time on NPR, and they had this round robin between these three religious people. And they had this woman who was a Muslim woman, and she said, for me to try to understand God is like a drop of water trying to understand the ocean. And I really went, when it comes down to it, that's basically what I am. I'm a part of it. I'm a part of this huge body, but I don't know. I'm over here by the shore getting washed ashore, and yet deep down there, there's deep down creatures, and over there, there's Japan, and I'm just a very small part. And it's enough for me to know that I'm just a part of it nowadays. That's about as deep as my spiritual life gets when it comes to understanding what God is. It's more important to realize that God understands me than for me to understand God. So I want to talk about a little bit about how much this room has meant to me and how much this clubhouse has meant to me. Because I've been to more meetings through my 37 years here in this clubhouse than I have been anywhere else. Skyline was my home group for years, and we've been to meetings everywhere, from every state we go in and every country we go in and try to go to a meeting. But here, it's like Skyline was my home group, and then this is my second home, and now this has become I've retired, and this is my second home has become my primary home. So this is my home. This place is my home, and it's always been that way. And the people that have meant so much to me in my sobriety have been here. And so much that I've heard that made a difference in my life comes in this room. And I wrote down a few things that meant something to me at the time and still do. And this one old boy said, there's more to drinking than just not drinking. And I said, okay, I understand that now. I understood that when I had those 18 months and wanted to blow my brains out. And someone else one time was talking about their Serenity Prayer shirt. And they went on to explain that their Serenity Prayer, that, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And that's everything outside of his shirt. The courage to change the things I can. You know, and the shirt had given him the wisdom. You know, so what that does is it brings it for me that sobriety is an inside job. Sobriety for me is not contingent and reliant upon external factors or people liking me or people loving me or jobs. It says in the big book again, jobs or no jobs, family or no family, doesn't keep us from getting sober. I was talking to Billy the other day. He said, I may have the monkey off my back, but the circus hasn't left town yet. I went, okay, I got that too. I'm one of the original, you know, there are those of us too with grave emotional and mental disorder group. And the really nice thing is that there are others here that are like me, and we know who we are, you know, and that's who we are. And we know it. And we're just kind of going along. We kind of blend in. And just Sunday, we're at the meeting Sunday, and Rita shared. And she says, my disease wants me dead, but will settle for me being miserable. And what that meant to me is that, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, and patient. And it's working on me all the time, you know. And so I have to work on my sobriety all the time. You know, my sobriety is my responsibility. It's not yours. We talk a lot about how we're all in this together and we all love each other. And yeah, we all love each other. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, that was my reaction, especially at first. But when it comes down to it, you didn't pick up the pen when I started writing my fourth step. There are things that I have to do alone by myself with maybe God's help that I do for my sobriety that y'all can't do with me. Y'all can share how you did it, but y'all can't do it for me. I have to take actions on account of my sobriety, and my sobriety and the quality of it is my responsibility. It's not your fault if my life, if it sucks. It's not your fault if it sucks. It's mine. There have been people in here that I hadn't been too wild about, for sure. But there have been people in here that I haven't, you know, that aren't too wild about me. You know, I think that kind of works out. I think that's it, part of any group. It's really amazing how the gal who led the discussion last week, Angela, she's a woman of color from New York, you know, and I'm a white Southern male, and it doesn't frickin' matter. It doesn't matter what our religion is. It doesn't matter what our color is. It doesn't matter our financial status, our money or lack of money. It doesn't matter our gender. It doesn't matter our other gender. It doesn't matter. In here, we are all alcoholics. And those people I might not care for, and if they needed something to stay sober, I would do it in a heartbeat. And I know that everyone in here feels the same way. Even if you don't particularly, you know, I'm not your cup of tea, you know, if I needed something, you would do it for me so I could stay sober. That is a brotherhood. That is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that we can stay sober. Some of the spiritual experiences I've had here in the program and some of the people. One of my earliest ones, the NAVA used to have a downstairs, served breakfast and lunch, kind of. I think it opened at like 10:30 or something and then went to like 1 o'clock. So they had a short order cook down there, and there was a lot of us that came in and would go to the meeting and then eat, have lunch afterwards. It was very good for fellowship. And one of the guys was dying of, John Burley was dying of cancer. And he sat down with me after everybody had left and sat down with me for like an hour and a half. And he told me about what was going on with him and how much pain he was in and how he said he felt like he was in the best spiritual condition of his life and that he was ready. And then a week later he died. But he spent like an hour and a half just sharing with me where he was and how he was. And it was such a powerful lesson for me of grace, you know, in this program. Bobby Meadows was a good friend of mine. His wife had died in an accident, a car accident? Yeah. And that destroyed him. He was very close to his wife. But then he got brain cancer. And he kept coming to meetings. And he kept talking about it. And I think his favorite thing that he used to always say is that the 12 steps are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature. If practice is a way of life, can expel the obsession and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. You know, just powerful words coming from somebody whose brain is literally being eaten alive and dying right in front of me. Bob Carver, his son was murdered, I think. And the day after his son was murdered, he sat in that chair right there at 11 o'clock and talked about it. You know, man, whatever going on with me, it ain't shit. Pardon my French. I know I'm not supposed to cuss, but it ain't squat. It really is not. I have these people giving me powerful lessons on how to live and how to go through life with grace and dignity. So we used to play ping pong in the fellowship. I'd meet down there with my sponsor, John. So much of my sobriety is wrapped up with it. My friend Bill Roop would come here all the time. And what Bill Roop always talked about was plugging into God. And Bill was religious, very religious, but he never talked about religion. He always talked about spirituality. He always talked about plugging into God. And from that, I've kind of expanded is that when I come to an AA meeting, I plug into God, and I'm plugging into the solution, and I'm plugging into AA, and I'm plugging into you guys. And when I'm at home alone, and I'm in myself, I'm plugging into me, I'm plugging into the problem, and I'm plugging into the problem. And I'm just, to me, here is where the solution is. You are my people. You are my my salvation. And you're my brothers and sisters. And I'm very glad to be sober today and a part of this group. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I am so thrilled to know you better, Steve. To find out, surprisingly, that you're an alcoholic. Stunned. Oh, I've asked Amy to come up and give out the tip.
My name's Amy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey.
Just like pretty much everywhere else, we have a chip system. We have a white chip for anybody coming in or coming back. I want to try this way of life. We have a silver chip for 30 days. Come on! Come back here and get your hug. We have a gold chip for 60 days, red for 90 days, yellow for 6 months, green for 9 months. I know I got one birthday, but does anybody else have a birthday?
Yeah.
All right, come on up.
My name is Nico. I'm an alcoholic, and this is 6 years.
Yay!
And I didn't do it. It was God and AA that kept me. So thank you guys.
Anybody else besides the one I know about? All right, come on, Miss Julie. be nice. Let me go sit down. I'm an alcoholic. Julie called me like the last minute asking me, was I coming? I was like, yeah, I'm coming. Will you please give me my chip? It's an honor to give you your chip. And she is my sponsor, so I'm kind of prejudiced over her. But I love you. There you go.
Thank you.
My little secret.
That's so beautiful, y'all. Thank you. I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. This is 24. I was thinking really 24 years ago, February 25th was a Saturday. And so the day before was a Friday. And I knew I was going to check myself into Ridgeview on that Saturday. But that Friday, I had a business party I had to go to. And it was out in Vinings. And I got so drunk at this business party. And I live near here. So, I mean, like the night before I was going to check myself into treatment, I drove home, like the one-eyed, trying to get home. It's just insanity. You know, just knowing that, I could have killed myself that night and just gotten this close to the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's what we do with alcohol. And so then I was thinking last night, 24 years later, I wasn't getting drunk. I was sitting on my couch watching the Oscars, and I was texting my 22-year-old daughter, who was watching them in Columbia, South Carolina, and we're just making comments to each other all night long about the Oscars. And I just started laughing when I got in bed. I'm like, oh, wait, 24 years ago, I was drunk as hell. I mean, my last drunk, and now I'm just having the best time talking to my daughter. And this place means a lot to me, too. My daughter took some of her first steps in that room across the hall there. Steve Corey took my son as an infant and walked him around this clubhouse so I could stay in a meeting. The people in this meeting, in this building, in this program, really, will do anything for you if they think you're serious about getting sober, and they will help you do it. They really will. So I'm going to tell this real quick. Deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It says that in our book, and I came to understand that when I got into the program. I didn't really believe in God. The higher power is necessary to stay sober for 24 years. It just is. If you're having a hard time with that, I had to finally kind of realize that God was actually part of me. It was in me, much like the water, a drop of water is part of the ocean. I came to understand my higher power was very much like Dorothy's ruby slippers. She had the power the entire time. She just didn't know how to use it. And that's exactly how I was when I was here. I didn't realize when I got here that I had had the power the whole time. I didn't have any idea how to use it. Dorothy's friends, who were flawed as well, had to help her understand how to use that power, And that's what you guys did for me. You helped me find my higher power and engage it in my life. And by doing that, I've been sober for 24 years, and it's totally amazing. Thank you. I know you guys are going to be fine. All right. Whew, 24 years. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. for something that set me free. Take me where the promise is.